Hello, everyone. This is Mike Parks at Intersecting Ideas, a podcast dedicated to talking about life and culture and bringing on guests who are specialists in their field, who have been entrenched in learning and education. And today, man, I got a great special guest. I've read through a couple of his books and I'm excited to engage in this conversation. It's Dr. Louis Marcos. Hey, Louis, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be on, Mike. Thanks for having me on. Looking forward to a good conversation.
Awesome. Can I call you Lou?
Yeah, please do.
Lou for sure. All right. So let me give, so for the audience, I always like to, give a snapshot of who's on the line. And you have a great background in history of ideas and philosophy, especially in, C.S. Lewis, apologetics, Greek and Roman history. You speak at lectures, classical lectures, and keynote speakers. You've written 25 books, professor of English at Houston Christian University. You're the Robert Chair in Humanities and a scholar in residence. So I'm looking to you for all the answers. How about that?
Well, I keep busy. Like you, I like to be sort of interdisciplinary, Renaissance man, try to draw from all the different majors and make connections and things like that. To me, that's the joy of learning. And most of my books, in one way or another, the connection I like to make is it's called bringing Athens and Jerusalem together. Athens means our Greco-Roman legacy, and Jerusalem means our Judeo-Christian legacy. And I want to bring those together. I mean, really, Europe is a creation of the serendipitous meeting of those two great streams. And they're no more enemies than religion and science are. People think they're enemies, but they're not. Because I believe, and I think you do as well, Mike, that all truth is God's truth. If there's a truth there, it's pointing to a higher truth. And I'm ready to learn from various different sources, even ones that may seem strange at first, right? We need to go out and learn and be open and wrestle with the big questions. Who am I? Why am I here? What is my purpose? How do I know I have value? That's what it's about. One of my heroes, of course, is Socrates, and his motto was, the unexamined life is not worth living. So that's what I hope we're going to do today, Mike. Let's examine.
I would say I am specialist in my work, but I am a generalist across the board. I love the history of ideas. I love the great books, whether it is from reading literature from even like Wiccans to atheists, agnostics, Christian philosophers, you name it. If it's out there, I'll read it. And I think that is a mark of a well-trained mind, the ability to read something, interact with it, engage with it, but not gobble down every ounce of it.
Right.
I
like to say that we need to treat the great books as a lathe. You know, a lathe is what you shape wood on. And so I said, imagine your brain is a raw piece of wood. And when you're reading these great books, you're shaping your mind against them. Mike, that's why both of us have lost our hair, because we've been really shaping against this, right? Yes, I mean, there's two wrong ways. One wrong way is to say it's an old book, so everything about it has to be true. That's just as bad as saying it was written by a dead white male heterosexual. Throw it out, right? I mean, you start to find out that people like Dante are pretty controversial. They're willing to wrestle with ideas, and as another thing Socrates said, let's follow the argument wherever it leads. Don't be afraid to follow the argument wherever it leads.
Yeah. Well, that's great. You know what? So the audience knows we're gonna fly this plane over and go down a couple of valleys. We're gonna look at four different areas. So just so they don't lose the forest through the trees here. So I want to begin to kind of touch a little bit on this is about the great conversation. That, this great conversation in the classics. Then we'll move into one of your books that I just recently read. It's called Atheism on Trial. Usually it's Christianity on Trial, but you've flipped the script on the, instead of being on the offensive, it's on the defensive. It's refuting the modern arguments against God. So that's the second area we're going to look at. The third is we're going to talk about a little bit, because I noticed that you have a love for Lewis, C.S. Lewis. So we'll talk about that. And then finally, we'll go ahead and land the plane in the area of like Greek and Roman mythology, like how that works in, like, should we believe that? you know, I see a lot of memes out there talking about it when it comes up to Christianity, you know, and let's wrestle through some of that. So with that, let's dive in.
Sounds great. Yeah. You know, this we are a product. The Western world is a product of the great conversation. Now, Mike, I want to start by saying something that really struck me a few years ago, because a lot of people say, well, why are we going to, you know, be colonized by Western civilization, right? It's white supremacy. Okay, people need to understand something, that the first people that were, so to speak, colonized by the great books were the Northern Europeans, the English, the French, and the German. The beginning of the great conversation is in the Mediterranean world, in Greece, in Italy, in what is today modern-day Turkey, North Africa, today Egypt. This is where these ideas were fertile and the conversation began. And while that conversation was strong in Southern Europe, in the Near East, and in North Africa, when it was at its strongest, the Germans, the French, and the English were all barbarians. They were civilized by that great conversation. And once they were civilized, they then passed it on to the New World. So we need to get out of our mind that it is, somehow originating in some kind of white supremacy. In fact, those people that are attacked, the Northern Europeans, were one of the first people to benefit from the ideas that were raised by the great books. That would include, obviously, the Bible, beginning with the five books of Moses. It would be the Iliad and the Odyssey, the great historians, Herodotus and Thucydides, the great tragedians, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, especially the great philosophers, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Cicero. In addition to Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, we have Virgil's Aeneid, we have Ovid's Metamorphoses. These are the great books. And of course, we carry on into the Middle Ages, from Augustine at the beginning to Aquinas at the end, to Dante, to Shakespeare, Milton. And we're moving on through the Romantics and the Victorians, right onto the modern day. And that great conversation includes people that I, as a more conservative person, a more Christian person, disagree with. Freud, Marx, Nietzsche, Darwin. But they're part of the conversation. We don't throw them out. We wrestle with them because they're part of the same human race. And, you know, I agree with some of the things they said. I disagree with more of what they said. But they are part of the conversation. This is not a kind of blind faith where we put ourselves in what today is called an echo chamber and only read the people we agree with. We need to wrestle with them. I mean, Dante, the supreme example of, you know, the great man, he put popes in hell. You know, he wasn't playing around with ideas. Ideas have consequences. And we need to be willing to read those great books and wrestle with them rather than look down on them judgmentally. You know, Mike, I used to go to a lot of the academic conferences, but I kind of burned out because most of the people at these academic conferences are not actually there to learn from Dante, Shakespeare, Milton. They're there to feel superior to them. And I thought, why did I go into education? So I enjoy speaking to classical Christian schools, to different groups. A lot of times, Mike, this might may interest you, a lot of times my best audiences that I enjoy the most are doctors, lawyers, engineers, businessmen in their 60s who missed the humanities growing up. They were trying to support their family. And now as they've gotten older, they realize, you know what? I need to answer these questions. I need to wrestle with them. And they, not the English major out in the quadrangle, it's the engineer that's often the one that understands the importance of the great books and of wrestling with ideas.
You hit so many points there that I wanted to pull on some of these threads. Like, I remember when I went back to St. John's, it was like it drew a swath of people from all ages. You know, Dr. Keith Flaherty, I had him on the podcast. He's a head of cancer research in Harvard. Oh. You know, he was on there to, you know, just people trying to become academics in the field have never broken in. And so it brings a lot of people with a lot of deep conversation, which I think is opposite to our current world, because a lot of times the sharing of ideas and opinions is squelter. it's smashed. It's either it could be intolerant or it, well, we've shifted. Actually, it was intolerant. Now it's simply canceling so that right. you shame somebody and put them out there because they have bigoted or hatred ideas, as opposed to the liberal arts where you're saying, let's engage in a great conversation and let's analyze these things and look at every argument possible.
Right.
And hey, what is the most logical, rational argument? Let's let that stand on its own. But I'm going to transition a little bit because you had mentioned the quote from Socrates, and I always say that an unexamined faith is not worth having as well.
Oh, that's good too. Yeah, we don't want blind faith. It is a faith. Yeah. A lot of people, Mike, seem to think that the definition of faith is believing in something you know isn't true. That's not faith. That's stupidity. Right? The Bible actually has a definition of faith. It's Hebrews 11:1. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the substance of things not seen, the assurance of things hoped for. It's a faith in what we sometimes cannot see with our eyes, but which we understand is a greater reality. There is nothing that makes me laugh more, Mike, than when I watch a show where somebody says, we have hooked a person's brain up to a camera, right? An imager. And we now know what parts of the brain light up when someone falls in love. And so now we understand love. It's complete nonsense, but we seem to think that we understand these crazy just-so stories. It doesn't tell us anything about what it means to be human, right? We are more than our parts. We'll mention C.S. Lewis later on, but a good way to talk about the problem here, Lewis wrote the Chronicles of Narnia, and one of them is called The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. They made a movie out of it, and there's a young man named Eustace Clarence Scrub, and this is a young man who has no imagination. He's been given a modern technological scientific education. If I can't see it, smell it, hear it, taste it, touch it, it doesn't exist. Empiricism, we call it. Well, at the end of his journey, he meets a magician named Ramandu. And it turns out that Ramandu is not a man per se. He's a star. Because at Narnia, the stars are alive. And when they retire, they come down to Narnia, to the earth. And when Eustace realizes he's talking to a star, he says, oh my, sir, where I come from, a star is nothing but a flaming ball of gas. And Ramandu says, no, my son, even in your world, that's not what a star is. That's only what it's made of. Our world is very reductive, Mike. What am I made of? I'm made up of so much flesh and bone and sinew and internal organs and all sorts of nasty looking things, right? But I hope that who I am is something more than what I am made of. But this is what's happened since the Enlightenment, that we think we can, Wordsworth, the romantic poet, I read in the Romantics too, the romantic poet Wordsworth said, sweet is the lore that nature brings. Our meddling intellects misshapes the beauteous forms of things we murder to dissect. We think we understand it, but we have to understand that the most important things in our life are often the things that we can't see or smell or taste or touch or hear, things that are beyond the physical.
And, you know, that's intriguing. So just a couple weeks ago, I talked to Brandon Rickenbach. He's a philosophy professor, and he was talking about the perplexing question for neuroscientists, that is, how do you get mind from non-mind? They cannot answer it. Kind of like you were talking about, love was trying to be examined. Also, in addition to that, there was another layer where he was talking about there's no answer for a unified whole. So if you have love over one area, you have triangle, you think of a triangle, you think of blue, you think of green, your arm, your senses, they don't know what unifies that. But the understanding of us having a soul, being a soul, body, soul, entity, that's not a question that comes up in Christianity. Right. There's an answer behind that.
Right.
It's the soul. It is eternal. And this, I think, ties into the conversation on your book about atheism on trial. So I would love to just transition into that, because Yeah, so we got the great books, a little bit dipped in
I
that.
know, yeah.
So
Well, listen, what's interesting about that book is that was not my original title, Atheism. It's so catchy. You can't, well, first of all, you can't really say no to your publisher. And it's a catchy thing. But my title for the book was Nothing New Under the Sun. Because what I've done, it's not
I'd like
exactly
that better.
atheism in trial. What made me write the book is I would listen to the new atheists, so Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, whatever, Sam Harris. And a lot of times the atheist, the militant atheist, speaks as if his theories of atheism are based on new research in science or history or psychology that you don't know about, you ignorant person. Folks, the arguments that Richard Dawkins and others make have been around for 3,000 years. There's nothing new under the sun. They've been around and they've been refuted, not just by Christians like Augustine or Aquinas or C.S. Lewis, but by what we might call the higher pagans, by Plato or Aristotle or Cicero. And people don't seem to understand. See, the problem with evolution is people now think that evolution defines every single thing about our world and our life. So they take for granted that people evolved from sort of animism to pantheism to polytheism to monotheism to science. This idea that we went from being primitive to civilized. Look, some of the oldest civilizations we know, Egypt and Babylon, were highly civilized. There were primitive people then, but there are primitive people today. We have to break out of this crazy notion we have that everything evolves. If anything, entropy seems to be the rule in most places, right? So everybody has this idea that everybody used to believe in, quote, creationism, and now all the thinking people believe in, quote, evolution. Look, the pre-Socratics who came before Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, many of them were materialists. I don't mean Madonna, I'm a material girl. I mean philosophical materialism says all there is in the world is matter. All there is nature. Sometimes we say naturalism. All there is no mind. What do you mean? Oh yeah, thank you, right? So Lucretius, now he's a little bit later, but he's before the Christian age, before contemporary of Virgil. And if you read On the Nature of Things, it is an evolutionary book. Lucretius, and he didn't make this up. If you go back to early Greece, you have what are called the Epicureans. And they believed that everything in the world was made up of either matter or emptiness, the void, right? There was no spirit. There were just little bits and pieces of matter. They called them atoms because atom means you can't cut it anymore. So they thought, of course, now we know they're smaller things, but they thought there were these little bitty pieces of particles. And they went through the void. And as they went back and forth, they randomly bumped into each other, creating new composites, new things. Boom. Everything we know is based on the dance of the atoms, and it's completely random. There is no order. Now, of course, at the same time, everything is deterministic because there is no free will. There's just this smacks into this, this smacks. This is not a new idea, but it was refuted by people like Cicero and others and Augustine and whatnot, who said, no, our world and ourselves are incredibly designed. Our universe is fine-tuned to allow for human life. Let me just show you how people, atheists, are recognizing how unbelievably tuned our universe. There is nothing random. There are all these incredible formulas, like the strong gravitational force and the weak gravitational force and gravity. All these forces, if they were off by a millimeter, life would not be possible. Why is our world so? Why is there the speed of light? Why is it that a scientific theory or what do I call it? Like a formula like E equals MC squared. The more simple and elegant the formula is, the more likely it is to be true. Physicists know this, Mike. That shouldn't happen in a completely random world. Now, to show you that people know it, but they still don't want to accept it, is there are more and more people that use gaming theory and say the reason why our world is so universal, so orderly, is that we're all inside of a simulation built by aliens, right? We're in the Matrix, basically.
Yeah.
Well, in other words, you're admitting that our world is incredibly ordered and designed. You might know that, what was his name? Ben Stein did a movie called Expelled, his documentary called Expelled, right? And now, Ben Stein, like myself, is a proponent of what's called intelligent design. We should not confuse that with a religious argument. Intelligent design says, let's look at the evidence all around us on the macro level, on the microscopic level, and what is the best way to account for the evidence. And the argument of great intelligent design theorists like Stephen, what's his last name? Stephen Meyer is probably the leader right now. There's many others. What's his name that wrote Darwin's Black Box? Michael Behe, Jonathan Wells. Who was the other one that was really great? Johnson, Philip E. Johnson. What these people said is, look, we're not talking about the Bible. We're not going to talk about ages of the earth. Only people argue over literal figurative. Look, let's just look at the evidence and what does it say? And what the evidence shows is that there is design in the world. It's not random. What is the origin of design? The only thing that gives design that we know of is intelligence, right? And it's got to be an intelligence that's outside of nature, because if it was part of nature, it would be just as random as nature is, right? So let me just explain quickly. Everybody understands what intelligent design is. If I am an archaeologist, right, and I've studied, very, very rationally studied archaeology, and I'm walking through a place, and I see a circle of stones, I can tell by my science whether that is a random circle of stones caused by erosion and movement, or if it's Stonehenge, I know that it's been designed. I may not know who designed it, but I recognize that this is something that didn't just happen randomly. If I'm walking through South Dakota and I look up and I see a cliff, and it's got the rough shape of a chin and a little bit like a forehead, and I might be, oh, that looks almost like a face. But of course, that's just erosion and it's random. But if I turn the corner and I see a mountain with four faces that I recognize as Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson, and Teddy Roosevelt, I know that this is not just complex, it is specified complexity, as William Dembski says. It's not just random, it's a language. If I'm walking along the shore, Mike, and I see squiggly lines in the shore, I can determine whether or not that's just the waves moving up or down, or I look at it and I recognize that's a language. Maybe it's hieroglyphics, maybe I can't read it, but I recognize that it is a language that has meaning apart from the sand and the shore. Okay, in this movie, Expelled, documentary, Ben Stein shows how it's not just creationism that's being kicked out of schools. Anybody that wants to talk about intelligent design will often lose their job. And so Ben Stein, who is a secular Jewish man, he's not a Christian, he got Richard Dawkins on the line, and they had a debate. And he said to him, you know, Richard, how do you explain the unbelievable complexity of the DNA? The DNA is not just complex. It is front-loaded with information. Even if you can explain to me the chemical composition of the DNA, you can't explain to me the massive amount of information, bigger than any supercomputer, the massive amount of information that is front-loaded and encoded into the DNA. And finally, Dawkins said, well, it could have happened like this. Aliens could have seeded our DNA. Now, basically, what he just admitted is that he believes in intelligent design. He refuses God as the designer, so he will posit aliens instead and not worry about where those aliens came from. Now, later on after that, he backed off and said, oh, he tricked me into it. But That theory is called panspermia. And it was not invented by Dawkins. It was invented by, anybody recognize the name Watson and Crick? Well, Watson wrote a book called Life. They're the people who discovered the double helix of the DNA. And even before we knew the even more complexity of it, Watson wrote a book, or was it Crick? Well, it was Watson, wrote a book called Life as It Is, where he suggested that very thing, panspermia. There was even a movie called Mars, Mission to Mars or something that plays on this idea that aliens seeded our DNA. Again, that is an admission that this thing that determines everything about us as we grow in the womb could not have happened by random processes over time and chance and the swerve of the atom. Oh, that's up for a mouthful. And again, these ideas that I'm talking about are not new. They've been wrestled with for thousands of years. There are certain times when the intelligent design idea is more ascendant. There are other times when the sort of random evolution is ascendant. But they've always existed, and the debate has always been there. So there's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah. Oh, that was good. You said so much, I'm not even sure where to go now. That was really good. So I was literally gonna ask a couple questions from actually from Lucretius and Adams, and you jumped right in there. But I was also thinking about the idea that of first principles for the existence of God, right? For those that may not realize, it's something out of like Euclid's Elements. We can get his first principles. It's a given basic assumption. It can't be deduced any further. Or Aristotle even talked about it as the first basis from which all things are known. Do you think that even though there's intelligence design, do you think even can go a little Kantian here and say, is there an innate thing within us as humans, do you believe, that points to a
I
creator?
think there is. So you've got, and Kant would say, right, you've got the starry heavens above and the conscience within, and both point to a creator, and not a creator who is the universe, but a creator who is a person, if you will, a being, because personality does not come out of impersonality. Mind does not come out of matter, right? It doesn't happen, right? So the macrocosm shows us the need for a designer. But when we look within and we see a conscience, see, C.S. Lewis once said, naturalism is self-refuting. What did he mean by that? Naturalism is the idea that all there is nature. Nature is a closed system, and there's nothing, a guy named, what was his name, Wallace, J. William Wallace, J. You probably know. He wrote, but he was an investigative policeman sort of person. And he started showing that if you're a policeman, right, and you come into a crime scene, right, one of the things you have to determine is everything I see within the crime scene, can that be accounted for by everything that's in this room? Or does it need an outside intruder breaking in? Right? If I come in and there's a man who seems to have committed suicide, I might say, okay, the proof here is that everything that happened in this room was confined to this room. But if I find evidence that, no, this man was shot in the exact back of his head, it seems to suggest an intruder from outside. You need an outside explanation. So that if naturalism is true, nature is a closed system and there's nothing outside of nature, even our mind. And yet, if naturalism were true, we could never have invented the rules and principles of naturalism because to study nature, we have to step outside of nature and study it. But if nature is the whole show, there's nothing outside of nature. But if we have a soul, a mind, something non-material that can stand outside nature and study it, then suddenly there's more than merely the physical. There is something metaphysical, something supernatural that is above and outside of that. Otherwise, we couldn't have come up with these principles. In a way, animals don't study nature because there's no part of them that can stand outside of nature. Only we as human beings can stand outside and even change nature and manipulate it, sometimes good for, sometimes for the bad. But we have only we actually see nature, right? A fish doesn't know that water is wet because it is confined within that element of its life. But we can step outside of that.
Mm. Oh, that's good. So you mentioned, like, I'm just thinking about, like, a meta narrative, right? Also, there's a grand story here. Like, just like there's a big story to the history of ideas, I think there's a big story to all creation, and bigger than just a microcosm or the dot of our existence. You know, it's not often heard. It's not about the dot. It's about the line that goes on forever. So that there was something within us, and I would, what Calvin used to call it, he called it the sensus divinitatis. Yeah, the sense of divinity, and that's historical. So I think Brandon was mentioning this. He's like, the idea of soul and God has gone back historically throughout humanity. It's not the unique thing to believe. It's right. Actually consistent with historical analysis. We've just seen this uptick. We've seen the Enlightenment, you know, going into rational understanding. Then, you know, then we see a decline, and then moving into a lot of atheism. It still holds. I think there's a sense of the divine in that we live.
And who was it? Somebody, Alvin Plantinga, I think, mentioned that both Calvin and Thomas Aquinas believed in the sensus divinitatis. And if both of those guys agreed, there's probably something to it, right? And yes, we have five senses, but we have something beyond those senses, a sense of the divine that goes beyond our material empirical senses. We know it. It is what yearns for. And, you know, children are naturally intelligent design theorists. As children, they naturally know that if they see something, it must have a creator. If you see a watch, it needs a watchmaker. The watch couldn't have assembled itself randomly by storms and things like that. So, but the point is that if there is a God, then there must be some aspect of ourself that can perceive something supernatural. And in fact, that's what we find in our... Let me give my favorite argument for the fact that our soul is immortal. This is a part of us that is beyond the physical. And it comes from a lesser-known book by C.S. Lewis called Reflections on the Psalms. And on literally the last page of that book, Reflections on the Psalms, Lewis makes his argument for the soul. And he puts it this way. Did you ever notice, Mike, that people are continually surprised by the passage of time? We see somebody we haven't seen in 20 years, and we say, my, how you've grown. No, I was going to stay the same forever, right? I mean, it's really, really weird. And we never, I don't think we ever quite accept time. I just came from the university, and you know, one of the few perks you have as a professor is you get to park a little closer. And you know what? Still, Mike, sometimes I park in the faculty spot, and as I walk to my thing, I say, what if a policeman sees me and thinks I'm a student? Really? I turned 60 in about 3 weeks. But and it's not vanity. It's not vanity. It's time seems like it should not control us the way that it does. We just, something about us won't accept it. And it's not just vanity. I don't want to grow old. It's a sense of something beyond, something universal that we get glimpses of. Okay, now, this is a strange thing, right? All we've ever known is past, present, and future. That's all we've ever known. That's our element. And yet people are continually surprised that time has gone by, right? Just celebrating New Year's. All right, now, that's a strange thing, Lewis says. That's as strange as if a fish were to be continually surprised by the wetness of water. That would be strange, wouldn't it, Mike? Because water is the element in which a fish swims, just as time is the element in which we live. Or as a famous Star Trek villain said, time is the fire in which we burn, okay? And we've never known anything, right? So it would not make sense. It would be very strange if a fish were to be continually surprised by the wetness of water, unless that fish were destined someday to be a land animal. See, We were not meant for time. There's a part of us that never really accepts time. We know it shouldn't have the control it has on. I feel the same. I don't feel any different. A few more aches and pains. What happened? When did I have kids? When did they grow up? My son's about to turn 30. When did that happen? Again, we take that for granted. But if we were only body, we were not. I do not think animals are continually surprised by the passage of time. They know nothing else. They just die. It's sort of like when Tarzan is sitting on top of the elephant and leading the elephant to the graveyard of the elephants, right? So you can get all that ivory. Well, when Tarzan comes close to the grave, he'll feel like this eerie feeling, this numinous feeling, this odd sense of the uncanny. But the elephant doesn't. The elephant is like, oh, right. Human beings are the only animals that are afraid of their own graveyards, afraid of their own death. Why? Because there's something in us that understands that it is so unnatural for us, for the body and the soul to be separated by death. And so we're always feel a sense of the eerie or the uncanny. I don't believe animals feel that because they're just body. They have souls in the sense they have personalities, but they don't have something that is separate, that can step outside of itself and study the world and study itself.
That's pretty wild. You know, and as we grow, I think we have a greater vantage point to look back on time. As time progresses in our lives, we look back and we realize how the brevity of time. And I think this ties into, and I'm going to bring this up because this ties into the Marcus Aurelius's argumentation. And I know you ended the book with, you know, a shout out to Aurelius. And when I first read his book, I was like, there are so many practical things in this. But so many areas that I agree with and didn't agree with. But I've seen an uptick, and I don't know if you noticed this. I've been in the fitness world, you know, virtually my whole
stoicism.
Life. And
stoicism is back.
Oh,
especially for men. But women too, but especially for men. Stoicism
is back. So athletes love stoicism. And the concept of, like, literally, you know, grab life by its balls, give it everything you got. But you know what? Have honor, have dignity, value, and, like, those structural things. I find from, you know, from a workout standpoint, an athletic standpoint, that's very appealing to men. You know, that gets to the heart of a lot of men. But let me ask, where do you see the gaps within Stoicism in light of this conversation?
It is. I have a whole chapter on Marcus Aurelius and atheism and trial. And I begin it with the wild statement. If it could be proven that Jesus did not rise from the dead, if that could be proven, then Christianity would be defunct. And what would I do? I say I would become a Stoic. I think if God has not really revealed himself or conquered death and all there is this world, I think the most noble and manly option is Stoicism, right? Understand what you can change and what you can't. It's sort of like that serenity prayer, but without God, right? God, give me the courage to change what I can change. Give me the patience to accept what I can't change and give me the wisdom to know the difference, okay? If you take the God part out, that's partly Stoicism as well. I think it's a very good ethos. The trouble with Stoicism, again, I think it's the noblest thing outside of God revealing himself to us. But there's no ultimate joy there, Mike. It's a leading a sort of protective life. I mean, it's a good life. It can be a life of honor. But there's nothing really beyond. A lot of the Stoics believed that, well, Marcus Aurelius says either we just dissipate and become atoms, or I mean, there's just not a final hope to it. There's a sort of sadness. It doesn't change the world. It becomes very, very introspective and inner folk. I talked about the great irony that Marcus Aurelius, this great philosopher emperor, he's the character, by the way, that was played by Richard Harris in the movie, what's the movie called? Gladiator. If you ever seen Gladiator, the one that's killed by his evil son, Joaquin Phoenix, right? That is Marcus Aurelius. There's an older movie called The Fall of the Roman Empire, where he's played by Alec Guinness. It's an even better movie, I think, although I do like Gladiator. Fall of the Roman Empire is even better. And in depicting Marcus Aurelius and his nobility. But here's the crazy thing. Marcus Aurelius was the last in a group of four or five really good emperors. And those good emperors, their names are Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, and Marcus Aurelius. And each one of them, rather than passing down the throne to their son, adopted someone who would be the best person to rule the empire. But for some reason, Marcus Aurelius, rather than choosing a good successor, allowed Joaquin Phoenix to take over. And his name was Commodus, and he started the sort of slow downward movement. And why? Because in Stoicism, there's not really a final hope. Now, it's kind of weird because Marcus Aurelius, in terms of his philosophy, I think comes very close to some of the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount. And yet, Marcus Aurelius persecuted the church. And that's because Marcus Aurelius thought the best way to get unity was by Stoicism, right? And I think he saw the church as a rival to that. He had all these great ideas, but again, there's something in it that you can't go farther. You sort of get stopped, and you can't move towards love, joy, hope, peace, what they call the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, all of those things that transcend mere duty. I'm a good man. I believe in duty. I believe in honor. But there are some things, I think, that even transcend those, and the Stoic can't quite move beyond that. I think they get far, but they don't move beyond.
I mean, it begs the question, why? Where did you get these ideas? Where did you get these concepts of good, of being honorable? Why is it noble? If this is all we have, then who is anyone to tell anyone else which way they should go, how they should be directed, what's good, what's wrong? I feel like when I read it, it's as if he's borrowing on capital, other people's just capital. And put that in into a worldview to build a base for these understandings. And I think we see that a lot, even in our culture today, where we still grapple on a little bit to elements of certain aspects of morality, but then the rest we toss out. But it's based upon a Judeo-Christian principle. Right. I think atheists a lot of times do this in their argumentation for their understanding of life. So they argue to be noble, to be good, to be, you know, to be loving and caring. But if you press on that just a little bit, it's like, well, where do you get the concept of all these things? How do you get mind from non-mind? How do you get love from non-love? How do these things come about in your life, and how do you stand on this? And I've seen that. So I think that ties back into this sense of the divine. There's a light of creation. There's a light of consciousness. There's this eternity that is written on our heart. And we span back and look at time, and we're like, oh my gosh, I'm getting old. It's so fast. Time is very light. I would say time stops for no man or woman, right? Yeah.
One of my colleagues over here at Houston Christian is Nancy Piercy. You should get her on your show. She wrote Total Truth.
I did one.
Jamie Leonardo. Yeah, she's very good. And she's really good. What's that?
I was going to say, for the audience listening, I had Piercy on, and she did, and we talked about her latest book, The War on Toxic Mask.
The Toxic War on Masculinity.
Yeah.
It's really good. I've got a review on The Federalist online. It's a really good book. But in some of her early books, like Total Truth, she and also Love Thy Body, she's really good at finding these great quotes from atheists who will actually admit, look, I know that we really have no free will and we're just, in a sense, robots, but I can't really believe that when I look at my child. Like, in other words, I can't really live by my worldview. You know, what is your worldview? Can you really live by it? Or like you said, are we living on borrowed capital? And of course, we may be using that capital up, which is rather scary. I mean, we're getting to a point where anything goes, right? I mean, I don't want to get it, but I mean, there are people that are now actually saying pederasty is okay. That's how far we've moved. I'm going to go into all that hot topic stuff. But I mean, once you cut yourself off from any standard, even Richard Dawkins has been starting to realize, you know what? If we throw religion out completely, we may not keep morality, right? See, can we be good without God? Okay. The answer is yes, you can be good without God, But you can't justify or explain your goodness without God, right? I mean, yes, you, because of the sensus divinitatis, but you don't, you know, there's a famous line in Brothers Karamazov, if God is dead, anything is permissible. And actually, Nietzsche understood that too. He was an atheist. He at least had the courage of his convictions, right? One of my colleagues, Jerry Walls, great, great writer, great apologist, has a T-shirt that says, Nietzsche is my favorite atheist. And what he meant by that is Nietzsche understands what it means. Right? He understands that you know, without any standard, you know, the only hope we have is that Übermensch, that overman, to rise up and control people. But he's understanding that God is dead, what it means.
I love reading Nietzsche because he was logically consistent in his atheism. So he literally bumped up against the wall and said, well, you know what? Life is meaningless. And if you have the will, and he argues for the will of power, the Übermensch, the Superman. And I think he was very consistent. Same with many of the existentialist philosphers.
Yeah.
You know, they were pretty consistent. Sartre, they're like, Sartre.
Yeah.
That's right. Camus, and, you know, you're rolling the stone up the mountain. And I think there's more to life than that. I think that when we talk about these topics, you know, I said light of creation, light of conscious, eternity written on the heart, this sense of the divine that has been stamped on us, that it's innate, that points to a creator. I think it points to something more. And whether we believe or don't believe, what I find is that we all live under God's world. And the way it functions, we can't escape. It's inescapable. So we are bound to the natural laws and the confines of what he has created and what he has revealed, so that we have to look at it and go, no, I'm going to push this and press it down and ignore it. But I think there's great evidence here. And as
I mean, look, you know, a lot of good scholarship has been done to explode this myth of science versus religion. Okay. People need to understand, why is it that science, as we know it, experimentation, all that sort of stuff, why did that arise in the West? Okay, the Chinese and the Indians invented things long before the Europeans, but they did not invent science. Okay, they have it now in the West. Why is that? Okay, and a lot of scholarship has been shown that all those early modern scientists were either Christians or strong theists, right? The only way you can do science is if you believe that we live in an ordered universe, that the universe is ordered and balanced and harmonious, reflecting its creator. We also have to believe that we can trust our senses to perceive that. In a lot of Chinese and Indian theology, Hinduism and Buddhism and stuff, the world is just an illusion. We can't trust our senses, right? So the ironic thing is, it was only that belief in theism, in a God who designs, that gave us the faith that if we look for it, we would actually find it, right? That we would find the laws of gravitation. Remember, Newton did not invent the laws of gravitation. He discovered them. They were already there. Nobody invented the mathematical tables. We discovered them. They're there, written. And in the same way, we don't invent morality. Morality is written in our conscience, the same way the laws of physics are written in the cosmos. There's a rationality to that. And so, you know, now it's funny that science has now tried to go away from the religious side. But if it goes too far, it's going to lose its ability to even put together principles that are universal. If everything's random, then why not? We need those first principles if we are going to explore and have faith that we will find real formulas underlying all of nature. We're still looking for the theory of everything. Why would you find a theory of everything in a completely chaotic, random world? There would be no theory of everything. It's an odd thing.
not very consistent. So, man, this hour is flying by. Oh, my goodness. So I want to talk a little bit about Marx here. And then we hit a couple of those quote, so we may skip that, and then I want to talk about some the Greek-Roman mythology. But let's touch down on Marx, because you had said in your book that if you were to remove a single person from the earth, you said, it would be Karl Marx. And we touched on the fact that ideas have consequences, and those that don't know, you know, he's a radical materialist. You know, yep. He believes in products of blind force in which we have no ultimate control. And I want to hear you, like, why would you pick Marx? You know, and I think you say over, even over here,
obviously there would, you know, be no, you know, Lenin or Mao without Marx, but I think there would be no Hitler without Marx either, because Marx is, you said the word, he is reductive. Okay. We are merely a product of economic forces over which we have no control. He makes a sort of pyramid. On the bottom of the pyramid is what he calls the means and modes of economic production. That it's those material economic forces that create the social and the political, and that creates the imaginative and the religious all the way on top. And it's crazy, but Marx says even our consciousness is a product of material forces over which we have no control. Here's another way to put it. Okay, we foolish Americans, we have this belief that this group of dead white male heterosexuals that we call the founding fathers got together and created democracy and later on created capitalism. He would say, no, that's nonsense. As weird as this sounds, the founding fathers didn't create democracy and capitalism. Capitalism created democracy and the founding fathers. Okay? He flips everything on its head. Now, the problem today is out of Marx comes what is called identity politics. The idea that we are not individuals, but we are part of groups. We are either oppressor or oppressed. We are part of a class. Now, the ironic thing is that the modern Marxists today, the woke people, they no longer care about the worker. They look down on the worker, right? They moved on to other things, male versus female, gay versus straight, cisgender versus transgender. But it's the same idea that robs us of our individual humanity and puts us into a group and gives us a view of society that is called a zero-sum game, right? It's that little pie graph, and if I get a little more, I'm necessarily stealing it from you. There's no sense of expansion here. It's reductive, and it is very, very destructive and has been destructive. Now, another thing with Marx is, you know, he denies, well, it's weird. He denies that we have inherent value and worth, but he also denies that we're fallen. He thinks he can build utopia, and everybody that has tried to build utopia has built a dystopia. Because the problem with man is not just ignorance. There's something in us that is rebellious, that's sinful. The Greeks and Romans didn't quite have the word sin because they didn't have a holy God to measure it. But they understood human rebelliousness and disobedience and the way it led to chaos. And again, Marx, he says we're the product of economic forces. For Darwin, we're the product of material biological forces. For Freud, we're the product of sexual urges. But you see, all of these modern people have taken the human and reduced it to, again, we're a product of things. So let's put it this way. We, especially English professors, we have this wonderful illusion that there was this great man named William Shakespeare who had this genius that allowed him to rise above his time and write things that were for all people for all times. That is an illusion, the Marxists would say. No, Shakespeare is a product of Elizabethan power politics. And he can no more rise above his time than we can ours. Of course, the Marxist thinks that he, of course, can rise above his socioeconomic milieu and study everything else. But this is a terrible view of humanity. It goes against every urge and desire and yearning that we have. Every knowledge of our specialness is gone and reduced to just material, physical, natural forces and processes.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. I think I have seen so much, and I wanted to toss this question out to you because I've seen so much of Marxist ideology permeate our culture in the West. So you got the Frankfurt School coming out of Germany, yes, which landed here, and those ideas from the Frankfurt School have just gone across, for in education. They have gone into our understanding, like We saw this in the rioting a couple years ago. The founders said they were trained Marxists. Many people don't understand these ideas. You know, they haven't read, the German ideology. But
yeah, there we go. Yeah.
The Communist Manifesto. Yeah. Like, this stuff is, it's laden with the understanding that, as you had already mentioned, like, he says the consciousness of men aren't determined by their existence, but their social existence that determines their consciousness, their social existence.
Let's combine this with our sensus divinitatis. Okay, we mentioned existentialism before, and the mantra of existentialism is existence precedes essence. In other words, we're just born as a blank slate and everything happens. Okay, I'm sorry. I don't care if you're an existentialist. I don't care if you're an atheist. Almost every human being you meet believes that they were born with some kind of purpose, and we are not going to be fulfilled unless we find that purpose and live it out. In other words, you may say that you believe existence precedes essence, but we all know essence precedes existence. We all know that we have a purpose, and most of what people do in therapy is trying to figure out what their purpose is, right? So you can say it all you want, but we understand that there is a part of us that not only transcends, but that is individual. We're an individual human being with specific gifts and a specific purpose.
Yeah, and I think some of this ties into, so people go to counseling for a myriad of reasons. What's happiness? What is my purpose? Where should I work? But they find their identity a lot of times within their sphere of work. If I get here, I will have arrived, and that has formulated me. So therefore, I'm in an upper class of, you got the bourgeois and the proletariat. I now have arrived to the other upper class. That's steeped in Marxist thinking right there. When you think that, because a lot of times, people will get into this position and realize, well, that doesn't satisfy all these longings and feelings I have about this world, why I'm here, where am I going, how did I get here, how do I have the ideas of right and wrong? Like, all these questions don't get properly satisfied. And I think that there was a theme that you had mentioned. A lot of these thinkers have given a naturalistic understanding of the world we live in. And I think that's dehumanized us when you press on these, understanding a lot. Or it's taken a very reductionistic stance in our modern culture, such as like our sexuality identify and defines all of us. Well, that's a reductionistic stance of you as a human, because you're way more than your sexuality. Jeez, you're well beyond that. And I think what you and I here are ping-ponging is that people, we live under God's domain, and we have value and dignity and worth because it has been given to us.
Right.
And that is the answer to this question of, I think this is why you wrote the book, Putting the Atheism on Trial, right?
We still use the word, I'm trying to find my vocation. Do you know what vocation means literally? It's the same root as the word vocal. It means calling. Okay, that's what vocation means. It's kind of like those people that say, I won't say Merry Christmas, I'll say Happy Holidays. Well, do you know what the word holiday means? It means Holy Day, buddy. Okay, we don't even know what we're saying. It's kind of funny. A vocation is a calling from outside of us, right? We speak of people being gifted and talented. Well, who gifts them? Nature gifts them? Well, maybe, but then again, if nature is just unconscious, how does it give us gifts, right? How does it bestow or endow us with things? So it's in our very language.
Yeah. I think we see that through the history of ideas. A lot of the arguments come out to be either a creator or nature, but nature does not have being essence. Right. And I think that that's the gaps that I see when I read some of these authors, like Stoicism. I see a gap there. There's, some good principles here now, but not for beyond the greater, that's for sure. Like, it doesn't go beyond in the realm of metaphysics. Now, I want to go down this rabbit trail just for a moment before we close out. But I want to look at the question of Greek and Roman mythology, because, we just had a new year. Christmas came by, and I'm seeing memes, and then the memes are saying, Christianity is nothing but a construct of mythology. Then I see the annual, the New Year's calendar is based upon just, Greek mythology as well. And my question to you is, you know what? What if all this stuff is just made up? How do you, what is made up?
Perfectly by combining your question with C.S. Lewis, believe it or not. Okay. Now, C.S. Lewis, I don't know if your listeners know, but C.S. Lewis spent about the first half of his life as an atheist before he became a Christian. But he didn't go directly from atheism to Christianity. At about the age of 30, he became a theist, a believer in God, one God. But it took him another year and a half to become a Christian, to believe that Jesus was the Son of God. What was holding him back, Mike? Well, like myself, C.S. Lewis was an English professor. And like myself, he loved mythology, Greco, Roman, Norse, Egyptian. He studied it all. And he was a big fan of a book called The Golden Bough by Sir James Frazer. Now, people may not know that name, but they'll probably recognize the name Joseph Campbell, who had a big influence on the Star Wars trilogy, right? We won't speak of other parts of it. Now, what both Frazer and what this is a person who studies all the ancient people groups, their myths, all these sorts of things, and they try to identify connections. They look for archetypes. An archetype is a kind of story or ritual or symbol that appears all over the world at all different times. A good example of that is every culture has its understanding of the wise old man, whether it's Obi-Wan Kenobi, Dumbledore, Gandalf, right? We are immediately the sensei. We immediately recognize this because it's like encoded in us somehow. Well, in The Golden Bough, Sir James Frazer identified a certain archetype that we've come to call the Corn King. Now, we need to understand that when a British person says corn, they actually mean wheat. When they say corn, when they want to say corn, they say maize. So the Corn King is really the Wheat King. Stephen, the Children of the Corn is a really funny play on Stephen King's. Okay, so let's talk about this. There's a story that appears all over the world of a god or a demigod, the sort of son of the gods who comes to Earth, lives down here, dies a violent death, and returns to the heavens. If you are Egyptian, you call this person Osiris, who was killed, his body torn to pieces, right? If you are Greek, you call him Adonis, or you call him Bacchus. If you are a Babylonian, you call him Tammuz. If you're Persian, you call him Mithras. If you're a Norseman, you call him Balder. These stories again and again and again, and they all sound like the story of Jesus. Now, Lewis thought, as a lot of people think today, that, well, Jesus is just the Hebrew version of the same Corn King myth. And if you go on the atheist websites, they'll say it again and again. Look, they're only stealing this myth. And that's what Lewis thought. Until one day, when he was 32 years old, he was taking a walk with his good friend J.R.R. Tolkien, strong believing Catholic author of The Lord of the Rings. And Tolkien said to Lewis, you know, Lewis, did you ever wonder, maybe the reason that Jesus sounds so much like a myth is that he's the myth that came true, the myth that became fact. Look, why is it that all these different people scattered around have this yearning, this understanding of a dying and rising God? Now, what it basically is a seasonal myth of life, death, and rebirth following the seasonal cycle. But why do we identify with that so much? Okay, well, the thing about Jesus is, okay, all the other ones, Mithras, all of them take place in mythic time. It's not real. It's a story. It doesn't have to be true. It's taking place in mythic time, and it's celebrated yearly. But the story of Jesus is historical. He was crucified under Pontius Pilate at a specific time and moment. The resurrection. You need a whole an hour to talk about the historical evidence for the resurrection. Christianity is a historical religion. And so, unlike these other myths, it really happened. But it happened without losing its mythic value. I learn a lot by reading the myths, because in the myths I see the deep yearnings of all the peoples across the world. But let's put it this way, okay? If you're a Christian, then you believe that Jesus's life, death, and resurrection fulfilled the Old Testament law and prophets, okay? But I would argue, as C.S. Lewis and others, Chesterton would argue, that Jesus also fulfilled the highest yearnings of the pagan people. He's not just the Jewish Messiah, he's the savior of the world. Mike, think about this. If Jesus came into the world and what he did only had resonance with the Jews, 1% of the world population, maybe 0.5%, and it had absolutely no resonance with the other 99% of humanity, it would seem as if a foreign God had invaded us. But in fact, we find quite the opposite. That in his death and resurrection, he brings to life, into reality, into history, without the horror of it, all of the highest pagan yearnings for goodness, truth, and beauty. So let's end with this. There's a difference between data and the interpretation of data. And my question is, what is the best interpretation? We began this hour by talking about intelligent design. What is the best explanation for the front-loaded information in our DNA? The best explanation is not random forces, but intelligent design. I want to say now, why all these myths? Because Jesus fulfills those myths the same way he fulfills the law and prophets of the Old Testament.
I like it. Sounds like types and shadows. Like
there's a shadow right there.
Yep. Fulfillment. Yeah. And I think we see that. I see that through the writings of Plato as well.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about mythology, you know, the Greek and Romans. You mentioned several areas here, but man, I could spend
another. You got to whet your appetite. We're talking about a worldview thinking or a framework. Ask the questions again. I'll end with this because we got to go. I'll end with this. When I was in sixth grade, we had social studies and we read the Epic of Gilgamesh, which has a wonderful flood story. And then your teacher tells you, children, we now know that every ancient group, from the Aborigines in Australia to the Native Americans here, they all have a universal flood story. And that just proves the Bible is a myth. And I remember even as a child thinking, there's another way to interpret that data. If every single culture has a story of a universal flood, that suggests to me that there actually was one. And maybe in every other culture, it only retained its mythic value. Only in the Bible, because God revealed it, do we have a more historical account of what happened. So again, data is not the same thing as the interpretation of data.
Excellent. Well, Lou, I want to just thank you for coming on. We're going to have to do this again. So thanks for coming on. I'm going to go and sign us out. So this is Mike Parks, everyone at Intersecting Ideas. Thanks for tuning in, and until next time.